They said, talk about things that you wish you'd known before you started teaching. Well, that list really is too long for the 45 minutes that they've given me, but I'll tell you some things about my own track into teaching and things you might find useful in your own journey from graduate school to teaching. Right, so this is me. Very bright-eyed and lots of hair, which has sort of disappeared since. I started graduate school because I was really interested in doing medical research. I am still really interested in doing medical research. I am more interested now in teaching than I was then because I wasn't the least bit interested in teaching when I started graduate school. I TA'd during my master's. That was fun, I suppose, but really I TA'd for the reasons that most of you TA, I think, is that it pays. So I still was not thinking about teaching, and there was never any kind of introduction to teaching. No one ever sort of took me aside and saying, look, you know, you're an idiot. That's happened a lot since, you know, you get married and anyway. I never learned anything about teaching in grad school. I still never gave it any thought. And when I did my PhD, well, I worked in a lab of a guy who was kind of an ogre. He did not want his students to do anything other than experiments. So I did a lot of experiments. I had no teaching. The only thing that closely related to teaching was giving journal clubs, lab meetings, and talks at meetings. And we'll come to that. But that is something that you should view as an experience in teaching, even though you may not view it yet. But we'll come back to that later. So I thought, okay, I graduated. I got my PhD. I went and I did a postdoc. That was also not focused on teaching. That was focused on experiments. And although the hair color is exactly the same as mine, it's not. It's not my hair, although I did for a while have hair like that, and my wife married me anyway. So there was no real. Postdocs are usually there to do research, to get really good papers, and then to either go on to a job or become an academic. but no one tells you that you should be thinking about teaching or university service. It's just like, get those papers out or you'll never get a job. It's true, the papers will get you a job, but they do not in any way prepare you for your life as a professor, as a teacher, as an academic. In fact, nothing about graduate school or my postdoctoral studies prepared me for any of that. So my first faculty position was actually in my second language. I came here to McGill to finish my PhD, and I ended up taking a postdoc at the University of Montreal, and I ended up staying, as David mentioned, at the Montreal Heart Institute to take my first faculty position. And it was drilled into my head the instant that I got this job was that, oh, tenure. Well, you have to teach to get tenure, and so that was my impetus to throw myself into teaching. Now, so after that message was conveyed, I have ever since actively sought opportunities to teach. And teaching 101 for me was when I realized that I would have to teach in French, not being able to speak French. I took Fortran and Basic and Watt5 as my second language in high school, right? That has not been terribly useful to me either, right? The first lecture I gave in French stands etched in my mind, and I'm sure I scarred a lot of students at the University of Montreal because I refused to speak English to them, and I don't think you can say what I was saying, the language I was using was French, because I wrote the whole thing out phonetically. It was like 50 pages phonetically. And my wife always says, why did you do that to them? They begged me to speak English, and I refused. So, But I did learn something from that experience, right? That was to approach any teaching situation from a position of humility, from a position of patience, and always, always keep a sense of humor about it. And it's important to retain a sense of humor because you're going to get a lot of evaluations, as I did, from students, which are really kind of vicious, you know? Students, you know, they write the review of you in a moment of anger, and then it's permanently attached to your record. You've got to kind of get zen about that, right? Not every student finds your particular teaching style interesting or funny or useful, which I suppose is the most important criteria. But after a few years, I got better. I mean, I actually became proud of my reviews at the University of Montreal. And as soon as I sort of got good at it, I got a job at McGill. And at McGill, you don't have to teach in French. So what that meant was that my teaching load effectively quadrupled, but I didn't notice because it was in English now. Right. So let's talk about life since. This is I think one of the pictures they took for my teaching snapshot. It's really a good picture of me, which is, you know, unusual and rare. I mean, most pictures of me do end up like this for reasons beyond my control, or like that. So I just want, and I don't want to make this terribly much of a lecture. If you feel you want to ask a question, by all means, just stop me and ask me, okay? Because I don't think I have 45 minutes worth of material, even if I'm funny, right? So I want to tell you about my experience, things that I wish I had learned before I got my first faculty position. So they're basically along the lines of this. Seek out opportunities to teach as soon as you can, right? And I'll go through these individually, but you should start now thinking about how to explain things to your grandmother, right? How do you explain what you are working on in your master's or your PhD or your postdoc to your grandmother? You'll think that's ridiculous. My grandmother will, you know, she won't understand a word I'm saying. That's not your grandmother's fault. That's your fault. So think about how to explain things to your grandmother. And then we'll talk about, well, my experience and some of the things I learned from my first faculty position and really more from McGill, actually. I will tell you about the different levels that I teach at. So I basically, because I have a, and it explains why I'm here, I have a congenital inability to say no. So anytime anyone asks me to teach, undergrads, graduate students, medical students, I said yes. And saying yes means, you know, you get more and more stuff piled on you, and I have a lot of teaching now, and I like it, but I hate it, you know? I enjoy the interactions, but it really is work, because I don't feel like I'm a very good teacher. I hope I do it responsibly, but I really do it for myself, and I'll come back to that later. That David mentioned that I teach to learn. The last thing that I will impart to you is something I kind of alluded to, is don't take the evaluations personally. Don't ignore them, though, because sometimes in those evaluations there are some real kernels of wisdom. I mean, even from young people. You know, it does happen from time to time, right? So, so pay attention to them. The ones that say you're an idiot, okay, tell me something I don't know, right? Help me. There's nothing I can do about being an idiot. That's permanent. That's, you know, according to my wife, again. I'm sure I probably shouldn't say this if it's being recorded, because she's saying, I don't ever say you're an idiot. Yes, but. All right. So as a graduate student, you should be thinking about pestering your supervisors to give talks as often as possible. Volunteer to do journal clubs. Volunteer to teach the person's lectures if he or she will let you. Get him or her to pay for you to go to meetings where you can get opportunities to present. Get involved as a TA. I mean, TAing now is different than when I was a TA. Really, I was a TA in lab courses where you're kind of helping to set up and you're trying to keep the students from exploding things, right? Now, as a TA, you can be involved in teaching from many different directions and many different levels, from just, as I said, helping to set up labs to actually giving the lectures to students, right? And that is something that most research-intensive professors would welcome the opportunity to have a good student who wants to learn to teach, who would do it for the reasons that they do it, like in good faith and responsibly, to spell them for a lecture or two so that they can do other things that McGill and, you know, the granting agencies demand that they do, which is write papers, do university service, and get grants. Right. So get involved as soon as you can, whether it's for money or for not. Every moment you spend in front of a microphone, in front of an audience, will make you less anxious about it the next time you do it. Will make you see the areas where you need to improve your speaking style, your pacing, your you know, you just look out at the people who you're talking to, and often they're like, "What? You didn't understand that." Because sometimes people feel intimidated by their professors for some reason. I mean, I think that's why I show the caveman picture, because it kind of says, "No, I don't want that. I'm not an intimidating person unless you're playing squash with me." But I want the students, and you should learn that is you should have the students be able to approach you, right? You need to be approachable as a teacher. That is the best way to one, get good teaching reviews, but to two, get access to those kernels of wisdom in ways that are less formal than the teaching evaluations. Because frankly, most students, unless you hold a gun to their heads, they don't want to fill out those teaching evaluation things on Minerva, right? It was better when the departmental secretaries came in with a piece of paper, stood over the students, tapping their feet and growling until those reviews were written. Well, McGill doesn't want us to do that anymore. We still do it, but you know, we have to kind of do it quiet-like, which again, I probably shouldn't have said on film. All right, so get involved. Now, think about how to explain things to your grandmother. One of the exercises I give in an upper-level graduate course, which has been really an eye-opener for me, is I give them a really complicated scientific article, and I tell them to write a newspaper article from that. And the first time they try to do that, there's like 100 million acronyms and abbreviations. It's like nobody in their right mind would pick up a newspaper and read that, right? The second time, there's less acronyms. They're kind of getting toward the key message, right? Every good scientific paper, every good paper has a key message that should be able to distill down into something that you can tell your grandmother, to tell a lay audience. Now, there's reasons beyond just, you know, making your grandmother more proud of you since you're already in graduate school or medical school or whatever. One of my students just got accepted into medical school, and he found out like about midnight. He got the email about midnight. And his grandmother is still yelling at him because he waited until 8 o'clock the next morning to tell her. So, you know, he's never going to live that down, ever. All right, so what are the advantages for you besides being able to explain things to your grandmother? Well, it really crystallizes your own understanding of the material, especially material that you might not be terribly familiar with, right? It is a great way to further your own understanding. It helps you frame out key messages. If it's one thing that really students don't learn how to do until it's almost too late, is to become concise, right? If you give students two long blank pages for a short answer question on an exam, they fill it, right? The answer is two lines long or a list of three things, but they want to dump everything that you could have possibly told them onto those pages and make you tease it out to see that they have the right answer. Concision is like it's like a spiritual gift to me if I see that in a student. So that's something you should think about developing. And the other thing is that, you know, in your career, wherever that ends up taking you, you're going to need to engage a lot of different people. So for example, as a scientist, I need to engage people who will fund my research, who don't really understand my research, who don't really, at the end of the day, see the value in my research, but I have to convince them of that. And it's certainly I have to convince my peers with the long grant applications and all the data, but really the people who actually fund research are the citizens. And when we lose the ability to convince the citizens of Canada that research is useful, you will see what we have now is that we've really lost touch with the citizenry. And so the government says, well, people don't really see the value of research. Why should we continue to fund it? Let's cut back NSERC. Let's cut back SHRC. Let's cut back CIHR. no one's going to care except those people who are applying for grants, and you know, they all have tenure anyway. So, you know, nothing could be further from the truth, right? Especially for a new faculty member, right? Not getting that grant for several years, not having the money to generate the research to publish papers, it's a killer, because the tenure dossier is it's empty, and there's nothing can be put in there to fill that hole if you don't publish papers while in your first few years. So engaging everyone, learning to engage everyone, I think it's critical to the survival of the academic enterprise, to the survival of the research enterprise. So get involved with that as soon as possible, and talk to your grandmother. I mean, I'm sure she's waiting for you to call her anyway. So. All right. So what happens now? You get your first job, and your department chair tells you, well, for the first 3 years, you won't have to do much teaching. We're going to protect your time. Don't get sucked into that. That is a trap to get rid of you after 3 years, right? When they evaluate you for tenure, they'll say, well, no one told us anything about you having protected time. Why weren't you teaching during those first 3 years? Also, the reason not to have your time protected is that it is, in a sense, protected because you're a new person, you don't have much teaching experience, that the students will be easier on you, right? You come in, you go, this is my first class, I've never taught before, but don't say it in tortured second language because they won't understand you. But, you know, they're going to give you a break while you hone your craft. If you wait until you're, you know, 3 years down the road, jaded and cynical because you're up for review for your tenure soon and you're worried about it, they're not going to give you as much of a break as you're young and naive and kind of happy and right? So don't protect your time. Get in there, teach. Teach as much as you can take. I didn't do it personally, but since coming to McGill, I've become more and more involved with teaching and learning services, and I become a member of the Inquiry Network. I got picked to do the teaching. I thought it was a teaching slapshot, but no, it was a teaching snapshot. But anyway, take the courses and workshops that are offered. There are many really excellent courses about how to use clickers, which would have helped today, I suppose, about how to teach students at different levels, about how to prepare materials for students, about the whole teaching experience. That teaching and learning services is a gift to McGill. I expect a big check for that. Yes. I'm kidding, but I never knew about any of that. I never sought it out, but because of my congenital inability to say no, I got involved when they asked me to get involved in things, and I have learned so much about teaching. Being a member of the Inquiry Network, that I cannot begin to thank them enough for the improvement in my own, just understanding how I convey material to students, right? All of these things that I'm telling you, I sort of groused out from my experience with teaching and learning services, even though it was informal and not through their courses. Find a teaching mentor. I was lucky, again, in that one of the best medical educators in the country was kind of the guy that wanted someone to replace him as the head of a coordinating of a large unit of medical teaching. So I volunteered to do it, never having taught medical students in my life, not having been trained in medicine, not knowing anything about clinical medicine. It was a great way to learn. I feel I could treat all of you for any problem you might have medically now, although you'd end up dead and I'd end up in prison, but you learn so much. And I learned so much from this teaching mentor, this guy who thought all the time about how to teach medical students, how to teach medicine. And so if you'll see in a department, the students will kind of gravitate to the good teachers. They'll be always there asking them questions. They'll be always there interacting with them. You do the same. You find that person and you say, listen, I need you to mentor me. You should find a mentor in your first faculty position anyway for everything, right? This whole business about protected time. A good mentor will say, no, don't do that. Just, you know, and other things about like, all right, let's get the grant going. Let's start thinking about the first paper. All of those things you need to do. You need to do it all at once, right? The university will say that you need research, teaching, and service. And you will hear that research is the predominant one that the tenure committees will evaluate. That is true if you have a great CV. If you have an okay CV, they'll say, well, you know, that guy we just looked at, he's got two cells and a nature. this guy's got a few JBCs, but he hasn't done much teaching, has he? Yeah, I see your point. Let's give him okay for research and unsatisfied. Anyway, you see, the idea to get involved, my congenital ability to say no is purely a defense mechanism so that I could get tenure. And it worked, because within 3 years of coming to McGill, I had tenure. And 9 years at the University of Montreal, every time you mentioned the word tenure, the dean would laugh. See, you don't need tenure. Don't worry about it. Then you lose your grants, and he says, we don't need you, and besides, you don't have tenure. You know, but he said I didn't need tenure. And see, it worked out well for me. But, you know, tenure is great. And in a sense, it frees you up to say what you think and to do what you want. And it doesn't abrogate, as many of my colleagues will say, your responsibility to continue to teach and to do service. In fact, it sort of says, I like the idea, like, my tenure, yeah, evaluate it every year. Say, if I've dropped the ball, tell me and give me a warning. Say, and you know, I like, we, every year we go through a merit exercise, right? If I publish some good papers, if I get good evaluations in teaching and I do service, I get a raise. I say, let's have a demerit exercise, you know, like all of these things to make professors kind of post tenure still be as good as they were pre tenure. But if you're going to do that, I mean, give tenure, you have to give tenure some meaning. I think that's fair. And I'm getting off trap topic. So, all right. So, getting into teaching right away, it lets you hone your skills in a sort of protected way, right? The students will give you a break. As a personal way to find good graduate students, what better way is there than to teach the undergrads who are going to stay in your department? You see which ones want to do research. You see which ones are interested in a career as, you know, as an academic. You don't see them like that unless you teach them, because they don't know who you are. I found that out teaching only upper level undergraduate courses. The kids in my department, sorry, the students and the children, yeah, in my department, you know, they didn't know who I was until they got to their last year. So I figured, okay, I'll start teaching them earlier on. I'll start interacting them in a more informal and informal ways. It's a really good way to meet students and pick the ones that you can work with, to pick the ones that you know that are interested in you and your research. And of course, it's really critical for your tenure dossier. All right. So as I said, I teach at different levels. I teach undergrads, I teach medical students, and I teach graduate students. And so it's one thing to teach them, but if you really want to see how courses are built, courses are designed, or if you want to, as I've written here, become the master of your own destiny, get the courses for yourself, control them, right? Become the coordinator, right? It is extra work, to be sure, but all of the accolades fall on you at the end. Of course, if you do it badly, all of the anti-accolades also fall on you. But I found that not saying no, saying yes, like I coordinate a lot of courses now, and I like it because I don't have to ask anybody about whether I want to teach this or that. It's good. So coordinating courses is different than teaching. It really gives you it really kind of allows you to see into how to develop courses, what works best, who works best amongst your colleagues for the right. I mean, there's aspects to teaching that really can't be taught, that have to sort of come through the business of creating courses and running courses. That's something that you should clearly get involved with. All right. Undergrads, you know, again, always approach the teaching with a sense of humility. I go in thinking occasionally I know more than the undergraduate students. And so if I don't know the answer to something, I'll ask them if we can figure it out together, right? And they're often quite amenable to that, right? Oh, he doesn't know everything. But this is something that undergraduates need to learn, and I'll come back to it, is that no one knows everything, right? The textbook does not have all of the answers. In fact, the textbook has very, very few of the answers, right? But getting an undergrad to let go of the textbook is very difficult, but we'll come back to that idea. So the other thing that I've noticed, because I started teaching, TAing in the 80s, right? No PowerPoint, as I said, just overheads and slides and the blackboard. You remember that thing that we actually write on it? Your hands get dirty, right? So with PowerPoint, the amount of information that we can transmit to students has dramatically increased, right? And I used to say, oh, come on, I never had any trouble. I just paid attention. I wrote down everything the prof said. But I realized that the prof is writing what he's saying many times, or he's drawing something on the blackboard. That takes time. It gives you time to kind of catch up. With PowerPoint, it's right there, right? The prof hits the button, and there's 400 pieces of data on that slide, and you're thinking, oh my God, is that on the exam? And so you know, we don't write on the blackboards. We don't give students the break that I mean, some really good teachers still do it, but now they use whiteboards. But we kind of put everything in front of, and it's easier for us, right? Because it's there. We won't forget it because it's on the slide. We see it. So I have realized that students are not losing their ability to follow the material. It's really, we give them a lot more material to follow. So you have to kind of take account of that when they stop and ask you questions all the time, or they stop and say, could you repeat that? It's important to recapitulate things, right? You have to be able to deliver your key messages more than once so that they know what you want them to learn, that they understand what the thing is that you will test them on for the exam or for whatever assignment you give them. And then you have to give students a sense of discovery, right? And I call this the edge. And I call it the edge because when you try to remove the textbook from the student's hand and you say, like, what I'm going to teach you is not in the textbooks, they're like, no, don't say that. No. I need the textbook. It's all there in front of me. But really, when they leave their undergraduate to do graduate school or whatever else, they have to realize that they have to learn that all knowledge is provisional, right? Well, not all, but most knowledge is provisional. Like, the textbooks provide a snapshot of the state of things maybe 5 years ago, right? So we teach them about the edge. We give them this notion that there are many things that remain to be discovered. And not only do you not know all the answers, but I don't know all the answers either. So let's talk about where we are now. So that means introducing them to research. And I think that's the basis of the Inquiry Network, is how to engage undergraduates in research. Now, all I don't know how many thousands of undergraduates there are, they cannot come and work in my lab. At the same time, there has to be a way to expose them to the critical thinking, to the notion that we don't know everything, that things might be this way or things might be that way, and this paper says this and that, and that other paper says that, that there's a fundamental dichotomy between what we say we know and what we really know, right? That changes almost on a daily basis. So Take the students to the edge. Get them to leave the textbooks behind and show them, you know, what you're interested in. Show them your research interests. Show them what other people in your department are doing. Take them away from their security blankets, right? They will thank you for it later. They will be extremely grateful. And in a sense, you will learn more, because you don't want to go back through the textbook yourself either, right? You want to push forward into the unknown as well. That's your job as an academic. At the same time, you kind of have to give them a sense of history. Some of that comes from the textbooks, but some of that can come from, you know, where the ideas that drove your own field of research, where they came from. You know, Stephen Hawking, or somebody wrote a book about Stephen Hawking, says that we stand on the shoulders of giants. We do. We stand on some fundamental discoveries that change the way we view reality, change the way we view history, all of these things, right? So give them a sense that it's a continuum. Like, you have to be looking to the future, but you can never ignore the past, right? And I guess I'm on a soapbox now, right? So that continuum is really important, that they have to know that there is an edge that they should be interested in, but they need to be able to look off the edge and back away from the edge too, in both directions. One thing that you learned that I have learned is that it is important to listen to them. Their concerns matter. They matter not only to them, but ultimately to you, right? Because you want to be the best teacher you can. And that's not something that, that comes natural, right? Because I'll tell you why I got into teaching later. But that, you know, I decided when I started I don't want to have office hours. If the student can find me, they could talk to me. And I am online 24/7. My wife says sometimes I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I spend an hour answering emails. I could go back to sleep. I sleep like a stone. But I also have this really strange habit of getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning on payday and paying all my bills because electronically. It's very satisfying to, you know, to tell Visa, no interest for you this month, you know. So anyway. So I don't have office hours. I like students to be able to approach me. And with email, it's so much easier. And now students, another thing that they didn't have when I was, that I didn't even have as a student is these damn smartphones, right, that can send emails. So they're walking down the street, oh, yeah, I'm going to send an email to my prof. And they're at the bar having fun. I'm in my office slaving away, but okay, I'll answer the email. But you know, I don't have a smartphone. I barely know how to work a dumb phone, right? Okay, so listening to students and taking their questions seriously and being willing to interact with them on their terms. You know, office hours, I don't find they work. And the other thing that is, you'll see at McGill, this is a big thing, collegiality. I don't think you should treat students with any less respect than you treat your grandmother. You may know us a bit more than the student, but that's the only difference between you, plus they're going to live a lot longer, but... and that's no reason to be bitter, right? I was young once. I sowed my oats. You saw the picture. I mean, I'd like to say I only wore that costume once, but I can't. So collegiality is important. And it's also that type of collegiality is the thing you want to foster between anyone you work with, right? I always say to students, like, 90% of the time in your life, you're going to end up working with people you don't like. It's a sad reality, right? You cannot pick your coworkers all the time. But you still need to work with them. You still need to be able to productively engage people that you are not going to want to have a beer with after. And maybe in getting beyond that point, where you can say, okay, I can work with them now. Okay, well, maybe I can have a beer with them occasionally, right? Oh, I don't like it, you know. But collegiality is something you should foster with students at every level. All right, the medical students. Anybody here want to be a medical student? Anybody here? Okay. Anybody here a medical student? Right. They're a unique group, okay? I teach a lot of medical students. They present a different array of challenges to other undergrads. They view themselves as not undergrads, but, you know, when they come out of CGEP, I'm sorry, you're an undergrad. You know, just because you're in medical school, you're still an undergrad. They come with, unlike students who take undergraduate courses, they come with widely varying levels of education. You can get a graduate student from English in medical school who, a cell? What's a cell? Isn't that where monks, you know, write? You know, they just don't know, right? So you have to think, all right, we are teaching people in medicine, we're teaching them more than anything, a way of thinking, but they come from different backgrounds, right? So it took me a long time to get to this point, but I realized that clinical medicine involves a lot of logical decision making. So a lot of what I try to teach medical students now is critical thinking, getting them to think logically. You want to do that for undergrads and other students as well, but it's not always easy, right? And engaging medical students is probably the most difficult task there is. Because they don't want to listen to you talk about pharmacokinetics and why this drug works and why that drug doesn't work. They want to get into the wards and follow medical doctors around. They don't want to have the shaggy PhD. You know, like, those evaluations are interesting. I get great evaluations now for medical students because I engage them. And it took me a long time to learn how to do that. But when you don't engage them, they're like, why is a PhD teaching medical students? But if you can engage them, they say, oh yeah, the PhD was great. But you have to engage them, and you engage them by getting them to talk. And so the small group format is great for medical teaching. The large lecture format, I mean, you're all used to it now. I don't know how many of you are on your cell phones or on your smartphones or have your computers open looking at your emails, but in the large classrooms, everybody does that. In the small classrooms, you know, you can single out that guy and say, hey, you want to put that away? And we're having a... And the other students in the room will also kind of get on that person too, because they're engaged. They want to know if you're telling them about how to make clinical decisions and teaching them science at the same time. They love that, right? As long as you can get in, tap into what they need to know. So learning to engage them is the most important thing that and that comes from experiencing what they like in small group settings. All right, so I'm almost done. Graduate students, I love teaching graduate students. I think of them as colleagues, pure and simple. I interact with them like colleagues. I hate it when people call me doctor this or professor that. Conversely, I hate it when some guy I don't know says that first thing, right? Like, oh, hey, Terry, how you doing? It's like, who are you? Oh, I'm a student in this class. Well, why didn't you call me doctor? You know, it's an interesting dichotomy, because as soon as he calls me Dr. Hebert, I say, oh, no, call me Terry. But if you call me Terry before you call me doctor, I get all bent out of shape. I don't know. Anyway, I like to interact with graduate students like colleagues. Again, the class settings are usually smaller and more intimate. You get a good sense of their skills, their interests. And what I found in teaching graduate students, it's not happening today, but saying less is better, right? Get them, draw them out of their shells and make them talk more, right? Like, it's not happening today, right? Again, the personal availability thing, right? Even students who aren't in my lab, I want to be around to answer their questions. I want to be around to help them. I want to be around to see them grow and develop into adults is not the right word. But when you see some kid who comes out of undergrad so unsure of him or herself, grow into this machine at the end who's telling professors, no, that is wrong, and I'll tell you the six reasons why it's wrong. That's perfect. That's beautiful to watch, and it happens with me with alarming regularity. But anyway, so teach them craft as well as content, right? You can dump data on them, but, you know, teach them what they need to know to become a scientist, which is more than just science, right? It's how to interact with and manage people, how to deal with peer review situations, how to write grants, how to evaluate grants and papers, how to design experiments, how to think about science. Teach them craft. In undergrad, I'd love to be able to do that too, but mostly we're kind of trying to get all the undergrads up to a certain level of basic knowledge before we take them to the edge. But the graduate students, you should be throwing them off the edge with, you know, all the time and teaching them how to deal with all of that. And also, there's an ethic associated with the practice of science, with the practice of any academic discipline, really, that it's our responsibility to impart to students. And so you should think about that when you're a graduate student now, saying, is my professor teaching me about the ethical dimensions of our field? No. Well, he's going to be, because I'm going to bust his chops on Monday morning or immediately by email, right? So, and then get graduate students, well, undergrads, when they come out, they're like, I got a degree. Oh God, what do I do now? They're locked up in a way. So get the graduate students to use their imaginations. When students start to use their imaginations, it is amazing to watch. And this is where they become, you know, smarter colleagues, right? And one of my own things, when I was an undergrad or a grad, doing my master's at a small university, I was a big fish in a small pond. I thought I was the smartest person around, you know. I was going, hey, I know that. I got to the University of Toronto, and for two full years, I was the dumbest person in every single room I was in. That humility, that willingness to face the fact that you don't know everything, that you often know less than most of the people around you, it was the most incredible experience that I ever had with respect to opening my eyes as to what I needed to learn, what I could learn from people, right? So, okay, I have two last slides too. So, and that also, that just the point there was that realization that I was the dumbest person in most rooms I was in made me think that I better start, you know, using my imagination a bit more to come up with something that made me like the next least dumbest guy in the room. But right. Evaluations. As graduate students, if you teach, you're going to get them, right? I mean, the problem, at least in the medical school, is that sometimes the graduate students see different people in the small groups each time, and one small group will love them because they're familiar with the material more than the next small group will hate them because they didn't give them any clinical insights. And you have to get zen about evaluations, and you have to take them in the spirit that they are ultimately intended, right? You have to ignore the insults and get at the kernel of what they're trying to say. At the end of the day, it's because you didn't make them understand what you were trying to make them understand. And there's always a learning process that you should never, that should never end, really. And so that is how I now view evaluations. Of course, if I get a good evaluation, I skip through the hallways and point at my colleague and saying, I got better than you. But I don't want to grow up in that way. So so why do I teach? David alluded to this at the beginning. Well, I teach because it's part of my job. To me, it's an integral part of becoming an academic. If I don't teach, I'm not doing a third of the tasks that I have been given as a professor at McGill. But I have to say that I teach for purely selfish reasons. I have learned so much, and I pick topics to teach where I don't know much about something just so I can learn. It's a purely selfish impulse. I have to say, standing in front of the class and delivering that content, it dampens that selfish impulse to an extent. Not completely. I still like to pick the subjects that I teach based on my own interest. Certainly, because I do that, there's always a few people in the room who know more about the subject than me, right? And, you know, sometimes they're shy about saying that, but sometimes they're not. So there's an aspect of teaching that reminds me always that I have to remain humble about my own level of knowledge. And teaching has taught me humility, and not just because of my first experiences teaching in French. They taught me a whole new level of humility, which I have held. But since then, I think that you have to be open to the fact, to the possibility that your students may teach you something. And if you are open to that possibility, you will learn a lot of things. And I think that you have to teach responsibly. It's an art. It's a craft. It's not something that, at least I never thought of myself as a good teacher. Whatever ability to teach that I have has been because I've paid attention to people who can do it. And that's why it's good to get mentors. That's why it's good to take courses on teaching. And you have to view it, I view it now as like, I want my own students to be able to teach well, or at least responsibly, if they can't do it well. And responsibly means, you know, well enough, right? Even if you don't think you're a good teacher, the students have to say, that have to believe that you are a good teacher. And I also never thought I would enjoy teaching. I thought it would be a pure chore. And it is sometimes, but really, there are aspects to teaching that are really pure joy. And that was a surprise to me. So be open to that possibility as well, that, you know, you may not think you'll like it, but you probably will. And I think I can stop, and I'll stop now, and I haven't given you much time for questions, but thank you very much for the invitation.
So we have a question at the top.
Yep. Well, thank you so much. Really inspiring. It's always really interesting with undergrad, because from the perspective of a teacher, that I agree with you, but then from their perspective, I think about the A's and the B. And that's how to break this issue.
So the question is that it would be great to be able to engage undergraduate students, but many of them are concerned with getting that A, right, to getting the good grade. I would say that if you look carefully, they're not all concerned with getting the A. You will see the ones who maybe think that I need the A to get into the professional school. I need the A to get into professional school. They're not going to get the A, right? You're going to be able to see the students who may actually be B students now, but they're really engaged with your course, right? They're a B student for this course, but never ever again, because they found something that engages them. That to me is worth its weight in gold, to be able to find the students who are not sure what they want to do, who are not really enjoying their experience, who are just going through the motions, but become engaged in your course, that is kind of where the pure joy comes in. Now, you're always going to have the students who just want the grades, but But they're usually willing to work hard enough to get them, right? And you could make them work hard enough to get them. So in a sense, you engage them that way.
Other questions?
How do we change professors' motivation for teaching? Because I think as a student, I'm not that interested in a professor who wants to do it because they want a better pension or internship. I want a passionate teacher.
Yeah.
They're passionate about their research.
Right. So the question was, how do I find professors who are as passionate about their teaching as they are about their research or their pensions? That's a great question. The trick is that if professors don't find that path themselves, the university has to be able to recognize teaching excellence in a way that it doesn't now. The university pays lip service to teaching excellence, but it does not foster it, because teaching excellence does not bring in $100,000 in indirect costs the way that a big research grant does, right? So in our current political economic climate, it's difficult to see how teaching can have the same place as research in the ideas in the heads of the bankers, right? But I would say that strongly that the university is shooting itself in the foot by doing that, right? Universities should be places of free exchange, of collegiality, of passion with respect to the interactions between the students and the faculty. That's what makes them interesting places. Otherwise, they're just schools where you go to get an A. So there's no easy answer to the question, but I recognize the necessity that, and I would say it's the university that has to kind of drive that passion.
As a kind of follow-up, do you think there's an opportunity to hire people solely on a teaching basis as opposed to researcher first and then teacher?
Right. I like to view the integrated professor types who want to do the whole academic exercise and do it well. Research, teaching, service. Separating them would mean changing the way that we evaluate tenure. I'm not saying that's wrong-headed, but that would certainly require massive changes in, right? Teaching excellence as the sole basis of tenure, the university doesn't do that now. It would have to change that. I think there have to be changes to how we evaluate tenure anyway, because now more and more researchers are being encouraged or being required or just by necessity to work in teams. And if you're the middle author all the time, current tenure decisions don't like that. But really, if you're the middle author who provided that critical team component that made the whole thing work, why shouldn't you get tenure for that? I mean, nobody could do what you do, right? Anyway, that's a whole other discussion. But the tenure decision would have to change to do what you suggest. So the question is, like, how to find opportunities to teach in courses maybe which aren't advertised for TA-ships. How to break into this idea that you need to get involved early. It's a good question. The short answer is there's no easy way to do it other than to see what courses you are interested in teaching and then approaching the coordinator and saying, look, I'm willing to teach, to help you teach, to volunteer. So courses where there's a small group component, like so in the medical school, for example, the 200 students in the class get broken into 15 small groups, each of which has to have nominally a professor, but a tutor, right? We're always looking for people who are willing to volunteer to do that, right? So you just have to find the courses where the professors would, you know, where there's a lot of people required to teach it. I don't know how to tell you to do that other than to look, right? But there are opportunities, right? And you know, a person like me might say, like, oh, here's a guy who wants to teach my lecture on pharmacogenomics to undergrads. I'll give him all the materials, and that frees me up from having to do, you know, 15 hours of work to prepare it because I don't know anything about it anyway, but I did it last year, and I'd have to relearn it all this year. Professors are always looking for help, you know, but they are not going to come and find you. You have to find them.
Even if I'm not a faculty member, just change my PhD, can any, if I approach any coordinator whom my area of expertise within this course and ask for volunteer of the lecture, I will be, I'm allowed to, even if I'm not a faculty member. I'm sitting at home.
Yeah, the question is, who can somebody, can anybody volunteer to teach? If you have the expertise, then yes, and especially if you want to volunteer, that's our favorite price, right? We don't have to pay you. We take advantage of your expertise, and it costs us nothing, right? And if you're bad at it, we just don't ask you back. If you're good at it, it creates opportunities for both of us. Yeah, I take volunteers in medical school from many different non-paying venues. People who just want to teach, who have PhDs, who don't have a job right now, but they just want to either change their mission so that they can learn to teach, or doctors who want to get involved in medical school but don't know how, they come to me. And so, yes, lots of people come to me.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Terrence Hubert.